Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. My name is Ramesh Vatalingam, and today I'm talking to Alan Winters, who is Professor of Economics at the University of Sussex and has been recently appointed as Chief Economist at the Department of International Development in the UK, a post he'll be taking up in September. And we're going to talk a little bit about where we are in world trade negotiations, with talk of perhaps reaching some kind of completion with the Doha round and its development agenda. Alan, perhaps you could start off by saying where we are with that.
The situation at the moment, Ramesh, is that there is a ministerial meeting due in a few days now. I hear a number of optimistic statements about it and how it needs a big push and everything will be fine. But I have to say, still being on the outside, that I haven't really understood the basis on which a deal is going to be struck. Agriculture is largely negotiated. I think that we're not going to discover further minefields on agriculture. But, of course, until everything else is struck, they don't have to dot every I and cross every T, even on agriculture. The non-agricultural market access discussions, essentially industrial goods, are still extremely sensitive, particularly with developing countries, the larger developing countries, so resistant to offering further liberalisation. And the truth is that we really have got very little on the table so far as services is concerned. The politics in the US are still quite difficult. They hope to get a deal that might be initialed or at least taken a long way forward before Bush leaves office. But even there, it seems to me that's a very optimistic view. So they may know something that I don't, and I actually hope that they do. But I'm not sure that I'd be betting very much money on us having champagne at the end of July.
This has been called a development round, and I guess the focus has been very much on the positive potential outcomes for the poor countries. What do you see as the benefits if there are agreement on all these issues that are on the table right now?
I think the benefits of a round are actually rather mixed. I'd like to come back later to the issue about the development round. It's something that's exercised me quite a lot. The biggest benefit of getting an agreement now is actually just to show that we can get an agreement now, that the whole system has not become so acrimonious and divided that no progress is possible. Turn that on its head, a failure of this round, an overt and explicit failure of this round, runs the risk of setting us off in a backwards direction quite rapidly. We have made many gains over the last 40 years, and it's not at all clear that these will be maintained if the political will completely evaporates. One has a dispute settlement system, but that still relies on countries' acquiescence in its conclusions. So I think the important thing is to show that we can agree on world trade, that indeed we can agree on anything in the world. Now, what else do we get out of a round? There will be some market access gains. They will be worth something. But in the end, in terms of actual tariff levels, this is not going to be a huge leap forward. Developing countries have got a lot of what we now refer to as binding overhang, whereby the tariffs that they negotiate in the WTO are the bound levels, the maximum tariff, but their applied levels are now a great deal lower. So they can make all sorts of so-called concessions in WTO specie without it actually affecting the tariffs that trade takes place with at all. In fact, we've let the developing countries make rather small offers. All developing countries need only offer 2/3 of the cuts that the industrial countries have been discussing, and least developed countries need make no cuts at all.
So what are the key forces acting against reaching an agreement? Is it about particular countries or blocks of countries, or is it about other interest groups? Is it about organised labour, or is it about industry interests? What is holding us back?
I think the answer has to be at two levels. And what's holding us back is that at the negotiating table, the country delegations have different views, they're pushing for different things, and their hopes and aspirations for the round don't quite match up, and so they can't agree. Now, why do they have different aspirations? Well, that's essentially because the interest groups to which they're responsive are pushing them in different directions. We see a resurgence, it seems to me, of protectionism in agriculture. Quite remarkable that when world prices go up, we have leaders of industrial countries saying that therefore we need more protection of agriculture. If one looks at developing countries, the manufacturing sector is very often nervous about trade liberalisation. And in some developing countries, India is a case in point, agriculture is also a cause for concern because of their interests in income distribution. So I think the fundamental drivers are that the aspirations that different interest groups have for the round are really not perfectly consistent. And a large part of the difference between now and previous rounds is I think that to quite a large extent the large industrial lobbies have lost interest in multilateralism. They've got quite a lot of what they want from the past. They think they can get more of what they want through regional trading arrangements. And indeed, they're finding other ways of addressing frictions to trade that are actually more interesting and more focused on what they think they require.
Can we come back to this issue of the relationship between trade liberalisation and development? And particularly thinking about, you know, tackling poverty in developing countries. This is something you've done a lot of research in. What's your take on that at this point?
I think it's useful to think about the effect of trade liberalisation on poverty in two steps. First, there is, I believe, a strong positive benefit in the long run. Essentially, a liberal trade regime is good for levels of income, at least for finite periods. It stimulates economic growth as you adjust to a new, more efficient position, and that, by and large, trickles down to everybody. Nearly everyone will benefit as economies become richer, to greater or lesser extents, but essentially poverty is reduced by aggregate growth. Then there's a more immediate, more short-term dimension. And that is the fact that trade liberalisation changes prices and changes, as a result of that, returns to particular forms of labour or other factors of production. And here the poverty effects really can go either way. If a trade liberalisation increases the price of staple foods, which quite possibly might happen in this round, then, say, the urban poor will get poorer. If it increases the prices of goods that the poor people are producing, again, might be in some other branches of agriculture, then, of course, there are big income gains for the poor and poverty goes down. Now, the work that I've done mostly with Tom Hertel in the University of Purdue leads us to think that, on the whole, these particular effects will be net poverty reducing around the world, but not to a huge extent, and that certainly in some countries we will see some strains on poverty induced by the round. My reaction to that is not that we should stop doing the round, but that we need to think about other solutions for the poverty. Let me give you a couple of examples. We think, for two reasons, that the round is a lot less poverty reducing than it could be. The first has been discussed quite a lot, and that is that we've focused to a large extent on agricultural export subsidies. It is true that agricultural export subsidies in Europe reduce world prices, and that is bad for other people who produce those goods. Argentina, a particular case, Brazil, to some extent. But it also happens to be good for the people who are net importers of food and net consumers of food, and they actually are more heavily represented among the world's poor than net producers. So in fact, the poverty effects of reducing agricultural export subsidies are probably adverse. Much more important is a focus on market access, that Europe and the US open their markets to exports, and that's the area where there's much less progress advertised for the Doha round. The second area where it's plain to us from fairly recent research, some of it written up as a CEPR paper, is that we've given the developing countries so-called round for free. We said you really need to do very little liberalisation. The work that Tom and I did suggested that industrial countries' liberalisation of agriculture would reduce poverty in the developing world. essentially because it raised the incomes of poor producers and was not fully offset in aggregate terms across the world by the rising cost of food that followed it. When we come to developing countries' own liberalisation, the two effects are exactly reversed. When a developing country liberalises its own imports, it reduces the price of food, and that is good for net consumers of food, and it correspondingly, however, reduces the returns to people who produce that food locally. However, the goods which industrial countries produce and which developing countries produce are different. And it turns out that for developing countries, we also have a net poverty effect from liberalisation, essentially because the benefit of reducing the prices of staple goods outweighs the adverse effect of reducing the wages of the producers. Now, if the Doha Development Agenda had placed a greater stress on developing countries also liberalising their own trade, not only do I think in the long run they would have had income advantages, they would have had some economic growth, but in fact the direct poverty effects would have been advantageous as well.
So what happens if the Doha round fails? Might we see progress? Might we see the bicycle of trade liberalisation continuing by some other routes, by countries taking it into their own hands, or by bilateral deals or regional deals?
It's very difficult to predict, and especially the future. The round crashing might lead to a great deal of acrimony and, in a sense, things slipping backwards. People will believe that the WTO doesn't contribute very much, pay very little regard to its rulings in dispute settlement. If we look back over the WTO's first 14 years, it probably was very, very successful in preventing the rollback of trade liberalisation during the Asian crisis. The Asian crisis was a very large shock for the Asian countries, and yet they did not slip back into protectionism. Some of the credit for that goes to their politicians, to the Bretton Woods organisations, but a lot also, I think, is due to the WTO. If we don't take the WTO seriously, there is a danger that with credit crunches and a recession coming, governments will just feel it's politically more expedient to slip back into protectionism. So that's one danger. It's not inevitable. The second case, as you said, is it might lead to a whole rash of bilateral, plurilateral agreements, regional agreements. These may or may not be beneficial. My own view is rather hostile towards them because they're discriminatory. One of the great advantages of the multilateral system is that it treats everybody even-handedly. Preferential trading agreements, by definition, don't do so. Some of them do bring benefits to their partners, but they almost all impose costs on the excluded countries. And nearly everyone is excluded from nearly every regional agreement. So I'm not terribly optimistic that regionalism will actually save us. I hope that the reaction to a failure now will be to take a deep breath, to say we really do need to keep the trading system open. Trade liberalisation is actually a fairly good thing for most countries, and that we ought to start on a more narrowly focused and round of future talks, and possibly also think about the modalities, the way that we actually arrange these negotiations. The WTO is pretty unwieldy with 151 members, each with a veto, and we do need to find a way of somehow getting the table to have fewer active participants while still regarding everybody's interests with due weight. That's a big challenge, but I think it's an area of research and policy contribution that academic economists and policy economists really could contribute heavily on. I think it's worth pointing out also the big beneficiaries of rules-based systems like the WTO are not the huge countries who, in a sense, have a lot of policy discretion, even in a rules-based system, or the very small countries who are small enough to be ignored mostly, but the middle-sized countries. It is the countries like Britain, like Europe, like the larger developing countries, India, Brazil, who have the biggest stake, I think, in the success of the WTO system. And I hope that we can somehow get that into the political domain so that there's a much greater coherence on the need to keep this system alive and functioning.
Final question, Alan. Can we talk a little bit about the rhetoric of trade liberalisation? What is the role of politicians and what is the role of economists in making the case?
Well, I think the role of economists is to think very seriously about whether trade liberalisation is a good or a bad thing, to put it at its simplest. I believe that the answer is it is in almost always a very good thing, but there are always doubts and questions, and in particular, people who do lose from trade liberalisation lose a great deal and therefore are very vocal. And economists do need to think hard about what can one do for those people in terms of general safety nets, finding alternative means of livelihood and so on. So I think the economists do still have some analysis to do. I also think, however, that the politicians have a very large responsibility, and that is basically to try and be more forthright than they sometimes are about the benefit that an open trading system has brought us in the past and is likely to bring us in the future. And in particular, to recognise that every pinprick of a little protectionism here and a little protectionism there essentially undermines systemically what has been really one of the great policy innovations of the last 60 years.
Alan Winters, thank you very much.
Thank you.